Anthony Head has achieved that kind of stardom in the States that presumably means he can't get from one sidewalk to the next without someone wanting to stop and talk Buffy with him. If you aren't familiar with the oeuvre that is Buffy the Vampire Slayer, then here are some facts. It's one of Time magazine's top 100 TV shows ever. It coined its own term, Buffyverse, to describe everything in it. The seven series of the show spawned novels, comics, fan films, every kind of merchandise, conventions and careers, and it has been a TV phenomenon. Anthony started out primarily, though, as a stage actor, and it was only after a series of highly successful coffee ads that he upped sticks and went to the States in order to avoid being typecast. He has since appeared in the Rocky Horror Show, NYPD Blue, Spooks, Little Britain and Persuasion, and you can now see him in Six Degrees of Separation at the Old Vic. He's also sung backing vocals on several of Murray Head's albums. You may recognise a shared surname there, and Anthony is an active campaigner for animal welfare. He lives in Somerset with his partner, their two daughters, some horses and a donkey. In fact, that's not true, is it? I've been updated since writing that cue, and I believe it's four donkeys, six to seven horses, five dogs and some rabbits. Are you unsure of the number of horses? Not count
well,
them.
A couple died last year, and it was one of those years where we had a lot of stuff going on. My dad died, Sarah's parents died, and also, as I say, so I think it's six. We also have a lot of horses going in and out. Good morning, by the way.
Morning.
We have a lot of horses going in and out because Sarah works with horses, so they come to stay, and we also have, you know, liveries and all sorts of things. So yes.
Yeah. I hoped it would be a kind of light-hearted introduction there, but I'm sorry, I seem to have brought up a lot of family grief and all kinds of things, but
No, you did say it wasn't going to be maudlin this morning, and it's not going to be maudlin.
Good.
No, you know, it's a new year, and it's all good, and the animals are touch wood, they're all very happy.
Excellent. tell us a little bit about going off to America and finding this extraordinary fame and fortune in Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Was that trip across the pond always part of the plan?
As a kid, I loved, my favourite show was Rin Tin Tin and the Whirlybirds. You're too young to remember those. But I always loved, you know, sort of an American movies. And I always thought that I was going to do sort of something in America. But the opportunity for English actors to thrive out there is, it doesn't normally rear its head. I mean, people do try and they come back with their tail between their legs because it's a very hard market out there. It just so happened that the commercial gave me the reason to go and try. It was just narrowing the market here. I was being offered lots of plays, but not an enormous amount of TV and film because I was, you know, my profile was so high.
Mm.
At the same time, I had this great profile in the States, which they have a slightly different attitude to fame. You know, if you've got a recognisable face, it doesn't really matter how or why, let's use it. So I went and had, you know, and I got an agent, and then I kept missing pilot season, getting it wrong. And the one that I did sort of get right was the mid-season, which is September, which is a mid-season replacement, when shows that haven't done very well get cancelled, and they look to their little shortlist of what they've got in reserve. And basically, I the first job I got was a thing called VR5, which went for 12, 13 episodes, and then I came back home, and then I went out and did a pilot. You know, so Buffy wasn't straight up, but it was, I wanted a show that would be seen here.
To what do you attribute the enormous success of Buffy? Because there have been a lot of other shows that have, you know, taken the same kind of material, but I mean, nothing has come close to the success of it.
Well, Joss Whedon, who created it, I mean, he basically was, when he wrote the movie at 19, he wrote this great script, which was not what was actually made. You know, he was the first person to really use wit, genuine wit, and good writing to support horror and thrills. I mean, I remember reading the script and just, I mean, literally, you couldn't wait to turn the page, and this is the two pilot scripts that I read, and at the same time, you were laughing out loud. I was in a restaurant on my own in Santa Monica, literally splitting my sides, and people were looking around.
Could that man leave, please?
What is the matter with that strange Englishman? But it was, you know, I think it's down to the writing. It's and absolutely down to the writing. I mean, it's used now as a sort of a great bastion of writing.
Yeah.
And you know, it has been mimicked in so many ways. And he also hit on the idea of, you know, an allegory of teenage angst, being, you know, someone who's having to fight demons and vampires. And
but the interesting thing is it's absolutely adored by parents as well, isn't it? And the same thing has happened with Merlin, which we can see you in on this side of the pond. You're playing Uther Pendragon, King Arthur's father. I wonder, though, whether your heart sunk a little bit when you got that script. Did you think, oh, God, you know, not another Arthurian legend?
I didn't think not another Arthurian legend, but it could have gone... it could have gone... down the sort of more children's television route, which there's nothing wrong with it, but I didn't necessarily particularly want to go down that route. I mean, I should have known better because Julie Gardner, who was responsible for sort of resurrecting Doctor Who and Ashes to Ashes, and she's been responsible for a number of great shows, was sort of behind it. That was my only fear, that it would be a little bit too light, and that there wouldn't be sort of, you know, I like to go to sort of dark places as well as the light stuff. I like something which makes you think a bit, and that's the great thing about shows like Buffy and Merlin, that they actually do. There is enough for everybody. It truly is a family show. It's not a show that, you know, talks down or talks up to anybody. There's something in it for the kids, and there's also something in it for the parents and the grandparents. And it's the universality of it that I like.
As a man of words yourself, and obviously a well-educated,
I don't know about
word,
that.
how would you pronounce oeuvre? Would it be oeuvre? Because one of our listeners, Edmund Pollinger, has already corrected me on that.
I guess I would probably call it. Oh, I don't know.
Oeuvre. Okay. Oh, wow. That's two against one. Then what would you say? I went oeuvre.
Au revoir.
Helpful as ever. Anthony, you've got quite strong memories of puppet theatre, haven't you? Not all of them good. Are you shivering in the studio?
It was my uncle and aunt. They were both great artists, actually, but at one point they took up puppetry. And I remember it was like my fifth birthday, I think, and they did Jack and the Beanstalk. And Uncle Lucien... he was a South American dissident, and his style was very Grand Guignol. It was very macabre. And so these puppets were really grotesque. And I spent the entire time under the table behind the sofa. To the point that, I mean, it ruined my birthday. I only found out sort of a few years back, I thought it would be interesting to do hypnotherapy, just because I thought, ooh, I'd like to revisit some of my past and find out what it actually looked like.
You paid 45 quid and that came up.
Under the table.
The only thing was, I didn't go through, I thought I'd find out, you know, sort of bits that I couldn't remember, because I find it very annoying that you can't remember that much of your childhood. Well, I can't anyway. But anyway, I didn't go to any new bits. I just revisited the bits that I do, you know, my landmark bits. But the lasting emotion, which what I thought was terror, was actually being ashamed, because my parents kept saying, come on out, everyone's looking at you. Really sad.
But the secret of the success of a show like Chris's in that piece is that it does combine, you know, very scary with, you know, very kind of joyful. And children actually do like that, don't they? That's the point of Buffy. I mean, you've got to have the good and the bad.
And I think the fact that, you know, you can do things, there's a fantasy element that you can do things. It's, I mean, I was just saying that when I was a kid, that all the TV shows, you know, were like Andy Pandy and, you know, Fireball XL5. Even the Thunderbirds, you know, basically it was all puppetry, because there wasn't animation like there is now. And it was the forerunner of animation, because you could do things with puppets that humans couldn't do. And I think kids love that element of not quite knowing. Yeah, and it gives them, you know, the boundaries of not knowing what, oh, is it scary and how much can I take of this. Doctor Who, everybody, you know, when you were kids, you enjoyed watching it from behind the sofa and closing your eyes at the bits you were scared by. I guess it's sort of, it's giving yourself the boundaries of what's... It's safer to watch something fictional that scares you than actually having to deal with it in real life. And it kind of prepares you for adulthood.
Yeah. Would you like to scare our listeners this morning, Anthony?
I'd really love to.
Because Helen Kay has said, can Anthony do his Mr. Gently Benevolent Evil laugh? It's totally brilliant. Could you do that?
That's not scary.
That one is. Now, Caroline Hutton did something new last week, and this is her email to us. Anthony, I wonder whether we could trouble you to read this one, the first one on the page.
Yes. Dear Fee, It's wonderful to hear Sarah Paretsky this morning. I always enjoyed the sheer excitement, physicality and politics of the V.I. Warshawski books. Hard Time was particularly good for those of us in middle age. I could never get to sleep after the Catherine Turner readings of Sarah's books on Book at Bedtime. Bleeding Gunsus was great too. Thanks for the encouragement to read Wolf Hall. P.S. I've never written into a programme before.
Well, we'll do our best. And finally, here's one from Beryl Hales.
Mm. I really enjoy 99% of the show, but find myself cringing each week at the poetry, which is read in an I am reading poetry voice. I have to run from the room to avoid it, as I can't ever find the remote control in time to mute it. Please ask the readers to try using their normal voices. Thanks.
Can you do that? Isn't the point that you've got to deliver it in a performance style?
What on earth can she mean?
Are you prepared to try your final poem in a very normal style? Not now.
You frightened me there for a second. I hadn't finished it.
Oh, so much to look forward to. The actor Anthony Head is our studio guest this morning. Plenty of emails and texts for you, Anthony. This one comes from Stuart Anderson, who says, I'm a big fan, particularly of Buffy and Radio 4's very own Bleak Expectations. However, Anthony's best work is surely his narration in Chris de Burgh's epic Don't Pay the Ferryman. Does he have any memories of working with the great man?
I do. I have memories of Chris asking me to do the... he did an Albert Hall gig, and he asked me to do it, and for some strange reason, I think it must have been the actor in me, I'd just seen Laurence Olivier in... I'd seen a documentary with him in naval lieutenant's uniform doing the speech, his big speech from Henry V. I thought, what a good idea, because it's the bosun speech from Tempest. Yep. So I thought, what a good idea, I'll hire myself a naval lieutenant's uniform, and I walked down the front of the stage in the Albert Hall, and I don't think anybody knew what on earth I was doing.
Did Chris de Burgh?
I think Chris was, it's like, oh yeah, Anthony's doing his thing, it's fine. I just went on, did my piece, and basically the album was produced by Rupert Hine, who had produced my brother back in the day, and so Rupert and I knew, and he had me come on and read this speech, and also I did some backing vocals on some of the tracks, but it was fun, it was sort of... it was something different.
It was. Well, it's stuck in Stuart's memory as well.
I think it was rather a good rendition of the person's speech.
Did you have a telescope?
No, but I had a peg leg.
Peter Derbyshire talking to us yesterday. Anthony, you have a very keen interest in animal welfare yourself. Do you find yourself recoiling at Peter's arguments for conservation and education?
I don't think you can recoil at arguments for conservation and education. I think that one of the most important things about, most animal shelters and most animal welfare organisations would immediately agree that education is the primary thing that we have to learn about what we are doing to species across the world. My only fear is that, I don't know. I mean, good luck to him, but it wouldn't be my first choice to keep 24 alligators or crocodiles in a back garden, however small or large. I think, something that you have to understand about animals is that, it's not enough just to love an animal. The animal has to love its life. And for animals to be in captivity, you have to be absolutely sure that you are, that it has a quality of life and that you're not just doing it for yourself.
Yeah, but I mean, Peter would undoubtedly say that his crocodiles do have a good quality of life. That's absolutely what he believes. But if you were given the last Cuban alligator in the world and a mate, and you looked at them and thought, if I don't keep these creatures alive, then this species goes. Isn't there an argument for not bringing them up in their own natural habitat and just doing the utmost to ensure...
If I was faced with that, I think I would find an environment that was the closest to theirs, and I would source that, and I would take them to it. I don't think I would necessarily want to have them in my care, and I would, I personally wouldn't volunteer for that. I'd like to find somewhere that worked for them rather than it working for me.
Yeah. I'm terribly sorry, I'm confusing our two guests this morning, and I've referred to Sean as Peter in our conversation. Yeah. I'm getting my species a little bit muddled up. My sincere apologies. You do quite a lot of fundraising yourself. Which are the animals in this country that you care the most about?
I generally care about animals. I mean, I've always liked animals, but my partner Sarah Fisher is she works with animals. She's a trainer. It's very difficult to really describe what she does because I'm not even going to start because it'll take quite a while. But anyway, we have a lot of animals in our care. She does. She teaches and she works with organisations like Dogs Trust, Battersea Dogs Home, Guide Dogs for the Blind. She also works with horses. She also works with, there's a really interesting reptile sanctuary from Birmingham. Lovely, lovely people who take on reptiles that people have not necessarily abused, but just through either neglect or misunderstanding or not really fully understanding how they live, have suffered. And I really like animals. I think they're fascinating. And I think we, you know, what animals teach us is invaluable, and I think what we do to animals in return is I can't say despicable, but we really do some stupid things with animals and some very unfortunate things with animals. And animals, you know,
They can't talk back.
Well, they do, actually. There's an awful lot of, you know, stuff that we don't understand. You know, that if you look, there's lots of calming signals and things that animals actually do try and say, would you stop doing that now? And in the end, because we don't hear them, it ends up with something unfortunate happening.
More details of what Anthony does do, he's playing down his charity work, is available on his website. Anthony Head has been our guest this morning. Now, Anthony, you have yet more work to do this weekend, don't you?
I do. I'm going to go off to do a matinee in a minute of 6 Degrees of Separation. One of the most... When David Grindley, who directed it, was asked why he'd wanted to do this play, he said, because it is the most perfectly formed play, and it is beautifully, beautifully written. It's 90 minutes, it just steams through. And I was energised last night by a bunch of people who came to see it, who just, I mean, they said, they were energised and enlivened by the play. They said it was fascinating. That, you know, it's the three things you want. It makes you laugh, it keeps you gripped on the edge of your seat, because it's 90 minutes right the way through, no interval. And at the same time, you learn all sorts of little things. It makes you think a lot, and it's that's what you want in an evening, or an afternoon.
How much longer does it have to run? Outside London, see it, because, you know, we annoy people when we talk about things that are on in London.
Well, it's the Old Vic in Waterloo and in the Cut. They will have to come to it. It's not going out to the provinces. But it's the first time it's been done since the 90s. It was a huge success on Broadway in the 90s. And David Grindley chose to do it because times are similar. It was done at the time of the Wall Street crash, and it resonates now. But it's a fascinating, fascinating play, and I would say to anybody from outside town, I'd say come and see it, because it's an evening. You finish by 9 o'clock. You sit down to see it at 7:30. You come out. You've got an evening left. It's a perfect.
You'll be able to catch Murray on in something. He's everywhere. Very late at night with that funny old voice of his. Anthony, it's been a real pleasure.
Well, it's been lovely being here.
Thank you very much indeed, and good luck with the rest of the run at the Old Vic.